Good morning and welcome to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Today on the program, we've got fundraising, Terry Tempest Williams, Senator Bob Bennett, politics, and much more. And joining me this morning in studio, government and politics editor Dan Harry is with us. Dan, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Also with us, health, education, and environment editor Rachel Piper joins us. Rachel, good morning.
Good morning.
Tribune religion reporter Peggy Fletcher Stack is here. Peggy, hello.
Hello.
And editorial writer George Pyle is rounding out the team. George, welcome.
Good morning.
And you are welcome to join us with the stories on your mind this week. Put those on the website, sltrib.com. Tweet to the hashtag TribTalk or call us, 801-355-TALK is the number, 801-355-8255. Let's talk about the big national story that's having a ripple effect here in the state of Utah. The Donald Trump train keeps gaining steam, and with no challengers left in the race, he is the presumptive nominee. How are Utah Republicans wrapping their heads around this? Because only 14% of Utahns supported him in the March Party Caucus. Dan Harry.
Well, you may have heard the old saying that Democrats fall in love and Republicans fall in line. And we're seeing that play out with the elected officials. They're falling in line. And some of them, kind of interestingly, won't even say Trump's name. They say, you know, we'll get behind the nominee. What do they say about Voldemort? He who shall not be named, or
right, whatever.
It is. That maybe we'll see some of that. My favorite, though, is Chris Stewart, who has called Donald Trump our Mussolini. And now, of course, he's falling in line behind him.
How does he justify that? Because just such a hatred and distrust of Hillary Clinton, or is it just pure party politics?
It is that hatred for most of them. Chris Stewart issued a statement, and I'm still kind of puzzled by it. It talked about how we need to unite behind our conservative principles and values. I'm not sure how that speaks exactly to Trump, because I'm not sure whether he is a conservative. And a lot of conservatives are wondering about that, too. You had an interesting guest on your program yesterday, Trib Talk, Holly Richardson, who's a former state legislator and very articulate. She's a lifelong Republican, you know, very devoted Republican. And she said she cannot vote for Donald Trump. She called him a misogynist. She said he will bring fascism to the country. And she said there is no she doesn't want to vote for Hillary Clinton, but she said she will not vote for Donald Trump. And she said a lot of the Republicans that she knows feel the same way.
And another staunch Republican on that program, Juan Manuel Ruiz,
right,
with the Latin American Chamber of Commerce, also called him an embarrassment.
Yeah.
It says that at least among Latino business owners in Utah, he is not popular.
Right. And, you know, Juan had some nice things to say about Donald, about his reputation as a successful businessman. But, yeah, at the end, like you said, he said he's an embarrassment. And he also said that he couldn't vote for either one of the two presumptive nominees.
George Pyle, are Utah Republicans who don't support Donald Trump, are they going to plug their noses and support the party like we see among the leadership ranks, or are they going to do something else?
That's going to be fascinating to watch. I mean, you mentioned Chris Stewart a couple of months ago. He was saying, you know, he's our Mussolini, and now it's looked like, and it goes from he's our Mussolini to he's our Mussolini. As I was saying before we went on, you know, Franklin Roosevelt supposedly said about the Somozas or some dictatorship in Latin America that was supported by America, they may be SOBs, but at least they're our SOBs. And it gets down to the fact that are you just going to support whoever is at the top of the Republican ticket just because he's at the top of the Republican ticket? Particularly in a spot where if he's the nominee and if he even gets elected president and you didn't support him on the way along, then what kind of trouble are you in? You know, you're going to want the president's ear. You're going to have appropriations you want. You're going to have bills you want. Have you made a very dangerous enemy by not standing up for him? Or should you stand on principle and say, this is not what we're about as Republicans? I mean, conservative columnists who aren't running for office, Krauthammer and Will and people like that, are saying he is not a conservative. He is not anything that the Republicans should get behind. On real policy issues like trade and immigration, he's not a conservative. And what scares conservatives like George Will is what he's trying to do is the opposite of what conservatives should be preaching, which he's saying, elect me president and I'll fix everything. Well, that's the opposite of what a conservative should be saying, is that the government is going to fix everything. You're supposed to fix it yourself. But, you know, demagogues don't get elected promising to let everybody lead their own lives. They get elected promising to fix things.
That could be a new campaign slogan. Fix it yourself.
No. Tell us how to work it out for ourselves. But, yeah, I mean, they're as you say, they're talking about we're going to support the nominee, not mentioning his name. Spencer Cox, the lieutenant governor, has been pretty aggressive on his Twitter and everything else, is saying that, you know, he's using the Never Trump hashtag. Yesterday they had this picture of Donald Trump supposedly eating a taco bowl from the restaurant in Trump Towers, talking about how much he loved Mexican food. And people were on running it down, saying the restaurant in Trump Tower doesn't serve taco bowls, and other pictures of strange things. And Spencer Cox tweets, "I was in Mexico for 2 years. I never saw a taco bowl." Mm-hmm. This is just ethnic foolery.
Well, I mean, it is a presidential election, so we do expect a lot of voters to come. Are Utah Republicans going to sit this one out because they just find Trump and Hillary Clinton so unpalatable? Dan Harry.
It well could be. You know, and we saw it in today's Tribune, a Libertarian candidate, Gary Johnson, the former governor of New Mexico, is saying lots of people are disenchanted with both presumptive nominees. Now it's time to start looking for an alternative. And, you know, some of the highly placed Republicans, not necessarily in our state, but others, have talked about maybe this is a time for a third party to emerge, not necessarily the Libertarian Party, but maybe somebody else. And, of course, in the back of many Republican minds in Utah is the idea of a Mitt Romney comeback. Now, I don't think that's practical. That's the dream of many Utah Republicans, though. And Mitt Romney now is saying he's not going to attend the Republican National Convention. He will not vote for Donald Trump. He's still talking about looking for an alternative, and I don't at this point know what that means.
Former Utah Governor John Huntsman, however, is saying it's time. It's time to get in line and endorse the candidate, and Donald Trump is it. So if you're a Republican, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps and get to the polls and vote for Trump. Yeah. Was that a message you expected to hear from John Huntsman?
Oh, it makes some sense. He talks about how we need to kind of have a realignment of parties, and we have too much polarization. And, you know, I think that anything that any Huntsman says is really kind of genius. So,
our new benevolent overlords, right? So, of course, the presidential race is not the only race. As I mentioned, George Pyle, what's this going to do for Utah Republicans down the ballot for local legislative races, for county commissioners, and the like?
Well, the fear nationally is that with Donald Trump at the head of the ticket, the whole ticket goes down. But I don't see that really happening in Utah. Utah is so overwhelmingly Republican. I don't see somebody going into the polls and looking at the top of the ticket and saying, I can't vote for either one of these clowns, leaving that blank, and then continuing to vote for Republicans for Senate and other things like that. And in Utah, I just don't see that happening.
So the Democrats are not going to have a landslide.
Well, no, not a landslide. I mean, in the Owens Love race, it could make a difference. Some of us were thinking, well, they're going to put medical marijuana on the ballot. That will draw a lot of people to the polls. That would help Owens, but that's not going to happen. That they didn't have enough time to do that. So that's not going to be on their drawing out people. Part of the question, a lot of places, are we going to have a low turnout? Are people going to be so disgusted with both choices that they just don't go to the polls at all, or they leave that part blank and just vote down ticket? It would make a difference to Utah in the sense that it would make a difference to the whole country, and that if the Republicans lose the Senate, then our senators, our congressmen, are less powerful than they were the day before. And that is, I think, what a lot of Republicans and real conservatives are worried about, is that the damage down ticket will be to the point that it's so gerrymandered that it would be really hard for the Democrats to take back the House under any circumstances. But they really have their sights on the Senate. There are some vulnerable seats. There are some open seats. And with Trump at the head of the ticket and all the negative advertising that's going to go out there, I do think they have a real fear of Republicans losing the Senate, and then our senator won't be president pro tem of the Senate anymore.
Okay.
And what will that mean for us exactly?
I don't know. Just we don't get to write about how Orrin is the third most – is two heartbeats away – or three heartbeats away from the presidency anymore. And he loses some salary, I guess, and all that Secret Service protection.
Let's move down ticket just a little bit. In the run-up to the June 28th primary, Governor Gary Herbert is finding himself in some hot water, particularly over his fundraising practices. And, Dan, what's the story?
Yeah, so the governor last week had a meeting, a private meeting with lobbyists, and, you know, lobbyists like to talk to reporters, too. And it turns out that he and his campaign staff met and made a pitch for this kind of speed dating campaign fundraising idea where if you wrote a sizable check to his campaign, you would get, you know, 15 or 20 minutes of FaceTime with the governor. And one of the lobbyists there that's working on the governor's campaign, Doug Foxley, described how he'd had this line of lobbyists come in. The governor was ensconced in the lobbyist's office, and this parade of lobbyists came through with their checks, you know, delivered the checks in person, and then had the FaceTime. And, of course, one of the most startling comments that came out of it was that the governor apparently said, from now until the primary, my lieutenant governor and chief of staff are in charge of the state. And, you know, even for lobbyists, some of the things that were said in that meeting were a little startling.
It takes something to shock a room of lobbyists.
A lobbyist, and they're kind of saying, whoa, this is a little too much. And then that followed up with the news that he is using this upcoming energy summit, which is partially paid for with state tax dollars, and Media One also is involved in that, you know, organizing these conventions, but that he piggybacked a fundraiser where he's getting large donations from certain of these mostly fossil fuel executives coming into town, piggybacked on this official energy summit.
George, the editorial board says this is just pay to play.
And particularly obvious pay to play. I mean, we're not babes in the woods. We know stuff like this happens all the time. But always the worry about campaign contributions is not that you've bought a vote necessarily, or you've bought a signature or a veto, but that you've bought access. That's what normal people don't have. Just FaceTime with the governor or the senator or their congressman. And it's just human nature, when someone has done something for you, like giving you money so you can keep your job, to feel indebted. I mean, if you don't feel indebted to these people, I think there's something wrong with you. And that's just the way it works. And what's surprising about it, all this campaign contribution stuff, the governor coming out the other day and saying, well, you know, on second thought, let's do away with Common Core and let's do away with SAGE testing. Because he's so apparently spooked by the fact that he came in second at the convention, that he's got this right-wing libertarian challenge from Jonathan Johnson. And he's – what polling there is, he seems to be way ahead, Herbert does, in just when they go around all the states and say, do you support your governor? He's always way at the top of – popular governors from around the country, and yet he seems to be really spooked. And I don't know if he knows something we don't, or if he's just not going to leave anything to chance, but it seems kind of strange that he would seem to be acting so desperately to backtrack on some of his political positions. I mean, he's been trying to tell people for years that Common Core is not a monster under the bed, and now he said, okay, there's a monster under the bed, I'll kill it for you.
Let's inform listeners, the governor changed his tune on Common Core this week. And this comes after 6 years of defending these educational standards that were initiated by the states. So is this a reaction? He sent this letter to the State Board of Education asking them to revisit the issue or encouraging them to change. Dan?
Well, I think to me the most interesting thing about the way he did this was he put it in the context of, oh, there's so much continuing controversy about this program that it's distracting from the real business of education. And it's kind of reminds me of the excuse for not voting on a Supreme Court nominee. Oh, it's an election year, and a particularly nasty election year. We couldn't possibly make an important decision during this environment. It's kind of like, well, you're helping to fuel that nasty environment by doing this. You just handed a whole bunch of ammunition to the anti-Common Core people, sort of undercutting what you've been trying to do now for a number of years. So, yeah, Rachel could probably address this better, being the education expert.
Benjamin Wood, our colleague, reported on that this week. What's the reaction from the Board of Education?
It's, you know, a measured reaction, but, you know, they're saying, we've been working on this, and we need to keep doing it. Sage testing has problems, but a new program probably is going to have some of the same hurdles that Sage did. And you know, they're saying Sage scores are going up slightly. The main worry, I think, for people in the education community is this sort of Utah unique standards idea, which they don't really know. What they're not, you know, Herbert and Johnson aren't really defining what that means. Is that, you know, only an idea that was unique to someone in Utah can be taught in a school? Because there's a whole lot of science and math that didn't originate in Utah. So people are worrying that just sort of this political atmosphere is going to sort of, like Dan said, just undercut years and years of compromise and education standards.
Mm-hmm. How is all of this going to affect Gary Herbert in the primary? The fundraising issues, the Common Core switcheroo. I mean, do you think George alluded to the polls? Mm-hmm. It appears that he's still poised to win. Do you think that's the case?
Well, yeah. From outside appearances, he's got broad support. He goes from a convention where, you know, everybody kind of expected him to have a pretty strong challenge from Jonathan Johnson. That's a different crowd. And now he goes from the 4,000 delegates at the Republican convention to potentially 600,000 eligible Republican voters. That's a different crowd. You know, that's a much more moderate crowd. But yeah, it does kind of look a little bit like panicking. And I don't think there are underlying polls to support that. I think Common Core was probably one of the issues where he thought – one of the few issues where he thought he was vulnerable with the Republican conservative base, and he's trying to, I guess, plug every hole. And, you know, and sometimes you kind of think politicians should maybe think they don't need every vote out there. Maybe they should sacrifice being in accord with their base on every single issue with – taking some leadership stances sometimes.
The primary, June 28th. Lots of reporting time between now and then. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW Salt Lake City, throughout the state on Utah Public Radio. We need to take a break. We'll be right back. Stick around. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and joining me today in studio, George Pyle, Peggy Fletcher-Stack, Rachel Piper, and Dan Harry of the Salt Lake Tribune. If you want to join our conversation about the week's top stories, you can tweet by using the hashtag TribTalk. You can comment on the website sltrib.com or give us a call. 801-355-TALK is that number. Let's turn to a story that the Tribune has been digging into for weeks now. Tribune coverage of the effects of the BYU Honor Code on rape victims. And this week, Peggy, you gave a different angle to the story. You reported how another school with an honor code deals with sexual violence. Tell us just a little bit about Southern Virginia University.
Sure. Southern Virginia University is a more than 100-year-old school, but it was purchased about 20 years ago by a group of Mormon businessmen. So it is owned and operated by Mormons. Most of the faculty, it only has about 700 students, about 40 faculty. The vast majority of the faculty and student body are all LDS. It has a very similar honor code to BYU. But here's one key difference. About a year ago, the school was, the provost was a student alleged sexual harassment by the provost. So the Federal Office of Civil Rights came in to investigate. They found the provost not guilty of sexual harassment, but they did find that the school had its process of investigating sexual assault, etc., was inadequate to their standards. And so the feds told the school they needed to improve those policies, and one of them was to put a firewall between the honor code and the Title IX office.
So that was about a year ago.
And so that's what they've done, and put into their honor code statement or student life statement a quote amnesty statement, which says any victim coming forward to report a sexual assault will not be herself or himself investigated for any rule breaking, any other break rules, drinking, staying out of after curfew, any of those things that are at issue with BYU. This Mormon university on the East Coast says, no, we will not. You have, quote, amnesty.
So how's it working?
I'm not there. I wasn't on the ground, but most of the people said it's working pretty well. Another thing that they had to do was have trainings about what is consent, when does no mean really no, which is all the time.
Right.
And so they've had workshops for the students and the faculty, education. They've really tried to change the culture of the school in conjunction with the Title IX office.
And so this was in response to a federal investigation.
It was.
Okay. Do we know if the feds are investigating or looking at BYU's honor code and the relationship with Title IX?
I jump in. They are not currently. The way those processes get started is when a student files a complaint with the federal office. Maddie Barney did file such a complaint about 2 weeks ago. But they have not, to our knowledge, initiated that their own investigation. Right now, the list of colleges that they're investigating is about 181 schools, and it takes them a while to launch these investigations. And they release a list every Wednesday. As of Wednesday, they were not investigating BYU.
Okay, but there's a very long list of colleges and universities. BYU is certainly not the only university who is dealing with a campus rape problem. And this week, we had another story about a case at the University of Utah. Rachel, what happened?
So last year in February, a woman said she was sexually assaulted off campus by a fellow student. She reported it to the school's Title IX office, and they said, we don't think that there's enough here to go forward with, so this is over, basically. But she was in the social work program at the school, and she kind of knew where to go. She went to the Rape Recovery Center, UCASA, and they said, you can appeal this and we'll help you. She got a pro bono attorney. She appealed to the school, and after 9 months, they convened a panel to look into it again, who then did find that it was more likely than not that this male student had sexually assaulted her. And so in February of this year is when that decision came down. But by that time, she and the other student had both graduated. And she filed a civil complaint with the federal office this week, saying that the U basically botched that for 9 months, basically her education was disrupted because of this. They took too long to convene a panel and to come to their decision.
We have so much reporting on campus rape on the website. So we're continuing to follow the story very intently. SLTrib.com if you want more detail. Let's turn to the University of Utah. And quite a few controversial stories came out this week. First, a popular and influential environmental voice announced she will not be teaching at the U anymore. Why is Terry Tempest Williams leaving the environmental humanities program that she founded, Rachel?
Well, it sounds like they wanted to sort of renegotiate her contract and give her a 3-year contract that would, you know, at the end of it, she would be done, reduce her pay. According to her, they told her that she was paid too much for doing too little, which is hard for anyone to hear. What Terry Tempest Williams is teaching was a graduate course where basically 8 students would be accepted in the program every year, and one of the classes they could take would be going out into the wilderness with Terry Tempest Williams and learning about the desert landscapes, you know, exploring the relationship with Utah's, you know, drilling rights and, you know, the effect on the environment and writing and just sort of and people who took the class seemed to love it. You know, they said that she's an amazing teacher, one of the best teachers they've ever had, et cetera. But the U sort of said, well, this course doesn't really fit into our guidelines. You know, you're not taking university vans out to these deserts. You need to be, there's some liability issues here, and some students might not want to travel. And so, you're going to have resentment from students who don't want to travel and now have to in your class. And then the argument sort of is like, well, if those students didn't want to travel, they wouldn't be taking this class that the entire point of it is going off into the desert with Terry Tempest Williams. So she, I guess, they got to an agreement where she was going to take less pay. And then at the end of it, they said, oh, and by the way, you have to bring all of your classes onto campus. You have to teach on campus. You can't be out off in the wilds anymore. And she said, I'm done. That's it.
So the University of Utah side of the story is we're looking out for our students?
Looking out for our students, just getting everything aligned with all of our other classes, all of our other teacher salaries, that kind of thing.
This came as a big surprise to students and backers of the program, right?
Yeah, I mean, the course has a waiting list. The competition to get in there is very fierce. People at the university agree with that. And there's a few foundations that have donated to the school basically predicated on this course existing. And so for next year, for at least one $50,000 grant to the program has been withdrawn.
I guess the contract renegotiation discussion was initiated a couple of weeks after Terry Tempest Williams had bought some property as a protest for oil drilling. So does she draw a linkage between the contract negotiations and her activism?
I don't know that she directly is, but a lot of people are sort of, other people are connecting those dots. Because her plan for that land was to take her students out there and sort of further the keep it in the ground movement.
Okay, well, while we're talking about fossil fuels, let's move on to another topic. The University of Utah Academic Senate voted to divest from fossil fuel investments this week. What are the details?
So this is a nationwide movement that these investment portfolios that universities have, a lot of those are in fossil fuel companies. And there's been a major call for those to be removed and invested elsewhere, basically. It sort of was a surprise, I think, that this passed. It was a pretty tight vote. It was 40-40 at one point, and then they recounted the votes, and it ended up being like 44-40, which is interesting. But so basically, they're saying, you know, they're not going to be investing university money in these accounts. And you know, there was the other proposal, which seemed like it was more likely to pass, was sort of a philosophical stance. You know, we're going to be looking into this, and our mission will be to explore other options. But this one is the divestment option is the one that actually ended up passing.
And this is something that environmentalists have pushed for a long time at the university. Mm-hmm. As you mentioned, it's sort of a national idea. But the idea of divestment has critics on campus, and they express themselves. So mm-hmm. what are the arguments that people made during this debate?
Well, you know, one of the things is, like, where do you draw the line if you say we can't invest in fossil fuels, and someone could say, well, I don't want to invest in this company or this idea, and then sort of where, you know, is the university then going to be losing money because they can only invest in, like, a handful of of organizations that maybe aren't returning money?
George Pyle, did the University of Utah Academic Senate do the right thing?
Well, I think so. I think, I mean, especially because, I mean, I don't, it's not really, they don't really have the final word on this, do they? This is their sense that they would prefer that the university not invest in fossil fuels. And actually, you know, it's to the point now where you might not want to invest in fossil fuels even if you don't care at all about air quality or global warming. They're just tanking. I mean, I've been keeping track on my blog of fossil fuels versus fossil newspapers and which one of them is in the worst stance. And it's easy to come up every couple of days with this newspaper's had this many layoffs and this coal company's declared bankruptcy. So, you know, you don't necessarily want to invest in either one of those right now. Now, California got out of tobacco stocks a few years ago, and now they're thinking they might get back in because they're actually going up. They're selling so many cigarettes in China, it's actually a good investment. I mean, Peabody's Energy has declared bankruptcy. All these other people are declaring bankruptcy. You think they'd get out of it just because it's a bad investment, not because it's a social or a political statement. But I think, you know, there are lots of public interest indexes and things that you can follow and people out there who make a living steering investments toward socially responsible investments. It's not like they're going to leave millions of dollars on the table by making this statement.
Rachel, other Utah schools are looking at this issue as well, right?
Yes. Was it Westminster?
Westminster College, and I think mm-hmm. Weber. Mm-hmm. So more reporting to be done.
More to be done. Okay. You know, one issue is that Utah is still very firm on coal and fossil fuels is the backbone of a lot of these communities' economy. And mm-hmm. so university saying we don't want to invest in what makes Utah great in some people's eyes is going to not be very popular in the legislature, I would think.
Sure, sure. Let's quickly turn to one last University of Utah-related story. Yesterday, more than 8,000 students graduated from the university. The ceremony had a bit of controversy. What happened?
The U gives out honorary degrees every year. I think there were three recipients this year, one of whom, Lynette Gay, was a philanthropist and then also was on the board of the World Conquerors of Families, which has come under fire for anti-LGBT practices and sort of promoting anti-LGBT policies. And
I think the Southern Poverty Law Center called it a hate group.
Yeah, and someone with the Human Rights Coalition last week sort of equated giving her a honorary degree to supporting someone who's a member of the KKK. So after all that, and again in this academic Senate meeting on Monday, they voted to she had resigned her seat earlier that morning, but it was a pretty heated debate and came pretty close to revoking that honorary degree. That didn't happen. She resigned from her seat, and the school sort of apologized that they had overlooked this and scrubbed it from their website. That wasn't their intention, et cetera. And at the commencement last night, there was about 10 protesters outside, and then a few students during the ceremony when she received that degree turned their backs. So not a huge swell, but still a statement.
It's an interesting picture. Check out sltrib.com. Again, just a fraction of the graduates turning their backs, but an interesting story. Let's move on to a true statesman, a staunch conservative, who nevertheless practiced the art of compromise, has died. And we're talking, of course, about Senator Bob Bennett. He was 82, had been ailing for a bit. Dan, tell us a bit about this man who represented Utah for three terms in the Senate, 18 years.
Yeah. He was a very interesting individual, a very intelligent, very thoughtful person. He looked like Ichabod Crane. He was about 6'7", very lanky. But he had this deep, deep voice and always had deep things to say with that voice. He was very conservative. He took the seat that his father, Wallace F. Bennett, had held and, you know, was a true conservative. He was not really a moderate individual in his politics. He was a very conservative individual. But one thing he had was kind of the old politician's idea that you wanted to get stuff done. You wanted to bring home the bacon. And he was very good at both of those things. And to get things done, a lot of times, meant working with Democrats. And he had no problem doing that. And so he got in trouble for that. In 2010, the Republican convention, state convention, decided that he was a sellout because he worked with Democrats and because he'd supported the first TARP bailout, that some credit was saving the United States economy. And they tossed him at convention. So he didn't even make it out of convention. And that really became one of the catalysts for trying to change the way that we nominate candidates. But
the whole SB 54.
Yeah, exactly.
Count my vote.
Right. But in the wake of that, you know, he took it graciously. I think he was deeply saddened by what happened to him. He loved being in the Senate. One time I went back to interview him, and he invited me to lunch with him in the Senate dining room, and he just, you could just tell he just loved being there, you know? He revered the institution. He enjoyed being a senator, and it was the place he wanted to be.
Utahns, of course, can see the tangible fruits of the labor that he demonstrated in the Senate. I-15.
Oh, absolutely.
We got libraries. Yeah. We got fire stations. Tracks.
Tracks was a big thing that Bob Bennett brought home the bacon on. Hundreds of millions of dollars. We probably have had the fastest growth in our rail transit here than any city in the nation. And it's largely built on federal money. And that's largely because of Bob Bennett. A lot of legacy that he leaves behind.
Peggy, you knew a different side of Bob Bennett because he's your uncle. And you wrote a beautiful, generous tribute in today's Tribune with a terrific picture. You got to see it because Peggy, if you've met Peggy, she is tiny. She's very petite. And then she's standing next to her very lanky, tall uncle. You said that he's very generous with his time, his resources, and had a very even temperament. And that seemed to serve him well in his role as a senator.
That he did, yes. I honestly, when Mike Leavitt said he had never seen him angry, I thought, you know, I don't think I have either, which is obviously known in my whole life. He's my mom's younger brother.
And you didn't see eye to eye, but he was a very gracious debater, right?
Yeah, absolutely. He and I sparred quite a bit about politics, but he never talked down to me. He never dismissed my opinion. And I actually think he learned something when we talked about health care that may eventually have influenced some of his thinking on that.
Well, it's a beautiful tribute. If you haven't seen it, sltrib.com. Dan Harry, Peggy mentioned Mike Leavitt. A lot of people are remembering Senator Bennett these days. And what are their memories of him?
Well, one of the things that sticks out to me is the people that were his political rivals remained friends. He remained friends with Wayne Owens, who he ran against the first time in the Senate. And it was a pretty nasty campaign. You know, Wayne Owens brought up all the old Watergate stuff.
By the way, he was not deep throat, right?
No, darn it.
That was a persistent rumor for years.
But he was a source for Bob Woodward. There's no doubt about that. His company employed Howard Hunt. And so, yeah, there were deep connections there, but no, he wasn't deep throat, darn it. But his opponents, Joe Cannon, he beat Joe Cannon in a very knockdown, drag out primary in 92 when he first ran. Joe Cannon spent $6 million on that race. It set a record at the time. And later, Bob supported Joe Cannon to be the Republican state chairman, and they remained friends. And Scott Lechman, a Democrat that he ran against, they remained friends afterward. So that's the kind of guy he was. He's like, you know, he would fight for his conservative principles, but it was done, you know, he'd take these guys out to dinner or, you know, they were friends.
We have another great remembrance of Bob Bennett from our colleague Thomas Burr. Again, both of these are at sltrib.com. A couple of services are planned, one in Virginia, one in Utah. I think we got the details.
Yeah, the one in Utah is, I believe, the funeral is a week from tomorrow, and the viewing is a week from today. So, yeah, the details are in the Tribune, the addresses and the times.
One more article to read if you're interested in the legacy of Bob Bennett. Our columnist Paul Raleigh said, "Politics today could certainly use more Bob Bennett's." Condolences, Peggy, to you and your family. We're talking about Utah's top stories. We'll be back after another quick break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW Salt Lake City throughout the state on Utah Public Radio. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. One quick note on another couple of stories that we've had recently before we get to our final segment. The 100-day mark has come and gone for new Salt Lake City Mayor Jackie Biskupski. How's she doing, Dan Harry?
Well, according to her administration, she's doing great. According to the council members, there's been some rocky times. And if you look at some of her appointments, you know, and the way that she got rid of people and then there wasn't an immediate replacement ready to go. Yeah, there were some rocky starts there. She also got some criticism this week. She delivered her budget address and everybody liked the idea that she talked about more money for roads and practical things. But one thing that a lot of people or several of the council members said was missing was a vision, an overall vision. Where does she want to take the city? Where does she want to lead us? And that's something now that I think it was four of the seven council members that I interviewed the other day all had said they're waiting for the vision thing.
George Pyle, the editorial board at the Tribune, was an early supporter of Jackie Biskupski. What's your take 100 days in?
Well, we have these arbitrary divisions of infinity where we go back and we say it's been in 100 days, it's been a year, it's been everything. Yeah, the start has been kind of rocky. A lot of the council members supported Ralph Becker for a third term. But part of the thing with the Becker fatigue and the fact that we supported somebody else and the voters wound up supporting somebody else was, you know, Ralph Becker had visions and a lot of people didn't like his visions. Bicycle lanes and parking meters and things that he became known for, even though he had loftier ideas, it became Ralph fatigue pretty fast. Somebody comes in with this grand design, which she's criticized for not having, that doesn't fix the potholes and get the trash picked up. And I think that's a little bit more what she's promised is, you know, I will not have my head in the clouds the way Becker was criticized for doing, fairly or not. I'm going to be down in the weeds fixing things.
Well, we will continue to watch very closely, of course, at the Tribune. We have a vested interest in covering the capital city. Let's move to our final segment, the underplayed story of the week. George Pyle, kick us off. What you got?
Well, I don't know how underplayed this is, but last night, Heat Raptors, overtime, the TV goes blank. What's going on? We're going to miss the end. It's an Amber Alert. Two kidnapped children, non-custodial parents, real fear that something really bad could happen. The Amber Alert goes all over the region, comes up on people's cell phones. If you've set it, like I have, set that. Get an Amber Alert. And due to the Amber Alert, they were found unharmed in New Mexico. There's a lot still to go in this case, but tragedy was averted. So. And we got to see the end of the game.
Not only that, but the Raptors won.
The Raptors won in overtime. It was a heck of a game, and we saw the end. So, but put up with that when it comes on. These are important announcements.
Absolutely. Good news all around. Peggy Fletcher-Stack?
So the KLM Airlines announced it's going to have a nonstop flight to Amsterdam from Salt Lake City. And I'm thinking maybe I should go there.
Sounds pretty good. Rachel? What's your pick?
Well, I'm sort of cheating. Emma Penrod, colleague who covers air quality and environmental issues, has four stories in today's Salt Lake Tribune. It was a busy day for issues of water quality and air quality. So probably the main one is if everyone sees red air days becoming more frequent, there's a reason. It's because of ozone and the new federal standards. So more things to worry about in the air.
Okay. And Dan Harry.
I'm going to mention a story that was done by Mike Gorrell, who covers Salt Lake County, and how the district attorney, Sim Gill, not yesterday, but the day before, went off on the Medicaid expansion, the what he called paltry Medicaid expansion, approved by the legislature and the governor, because it covers so few people. It leaves so many people uninsured, and he really was upset that there was this sort of self-congratulatory praise for the legislature and the governor and others praising them for finally passing this, but it was such a meager, skimpy plan that he said, you know, we should be ashamed rather than applauding it.
Mm. Again, check that out, sltrib.com. My pick is going to be mansions. Apparently, if you are shopping for a very large home, Salt Lake City, Provo Orem, and Ogden Clearfield rank among the top cities in the country for the number of mansions they have. The number quoted by our colleague Tony Semerad is 1.4%. 14 of every 1,000 homes has more than, I think it's 5 bedrooms and at least 15 rooms total. Big homes, big families. It's Utah. Thank you so much, everybody, for joining us today. Dan Harry, Peggy Fletcher-Stack, Rachel Piper, George Pyle. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And we're going to wrap up this week with Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. This week, Kirby considers vacationing in outer space.
Provided you have enough money, you can go pay some government to shoot you into space and have a good time while you're up there, presumably.
Would you do it?
If I had the money?
Yeah.
No, I'd rather buy Cuba instead. But, I mean, if I won a chance to go, would I risk it? Yeah, you bet I would. It'd be nice to see the Earth from off Earth. And, I'd probably do it. But it'd depend on how long it would take, you know. None of this time travel stuff where you're gone for 24 years and come back and it's only been a minute, but you've still managed to age. So no, I wouldn't do that.
You wrote about space travel.
Is it going to change?
A while ago.
Oh, yeah. It was back in like the early 2000s, 2001 or so, that this Russian guy paid to actually be shot into space. And it was an astronomical sum, no pun intended, that he shelled out in order to go into space. And so I started thinking how space tourism was going to change everything for people. And in a column I wrote, I said, space tourism is going to change everything. Just like traveling to the Galapagos now, eventually space won't even be dangerous enough to kill off people who don't belong there. The travel industry is just itching to get its hands on space travel, so it can offer 2 days, 3 nights with prime rib on Saturn. And don't forget your lucky roll of nickels for the oxygen slots. Kids will travel to Canis Minor for spring break. Businessmen will attend seminars on Corona Borealis Mariotis. And everyone who retires in New York will move to New Florida, which revolves around not one, but two suns. Still, there are some disadvantages to space vacations. For starters, it's big, huge. Some places you won't even live long enough to get to, which, come to think of it, is almost like LaGuardia is right now. If you think it takes a long time to get anywhere in space now, just wait until the motorhome crowd gets up there. Imagine traveling all the way to Alpha Centauri behind some retiree in a no-airstream.
Are we going to see this in our lifetimes?
Well, probably not ours, but definitely in our children's.
Yeah?
I mean, things happen fast now. And I'll be glad that I'm dead. I mean, who wants to drive to another galaxy with a kid's howling in the back seat? Are we there yet? I mean, 5 light years spent doing that? No, no thanks.
That's Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. There's no one like Kirby. Kirby archives are all online at sltrib.com. That's it for this edition of Behind the Headlines, a production of KCPW Radio, Utah Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks to Jesse Ellis at KCPW, Bennett Purser and Jessica Sonderegger at UPR, and Emily Means from the Salt Lake Tribune. And for those listening on KCPW, stay tuned. We'll have a rebroadcast of our recent Pulitzer Prize party. Pulitzer Prize party featuring award-winning literature. So much fun hearing from our local resident intellectuals. Again, that's coming up next here on KCPW. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend.